This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Today I'll be welcoming two old friends. I sort of think of them as friends, although I've never met either one of them. But they are authors whose books I've discussed in the past, and I'm quite eager to discuss again today. The first is Andrew Sean Greer, San Francisco novelist. He's written four books, but sort of made his name 5 years ago with The Confessions of Max Tivoli, which is sort of a better done version of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And then he has a new novel, The Story of a Marriage, which came out last year and has just been reissued in paperback. And in the second half of the program, I'm going to talk with David Carl, who's written a number of very informative books for the University of California Press's California Natural History series. We've talked to him before about an introduction to water in California, an introduction to air in California and an introduction to fire in California. Today we're going to talk about water. So now I hope I have on the line Andy Greer. Welcome back to Booktown.
Thanks.
These two books are so similar and so different in a number of ways. I thought of a couple of things. At the beginning of Max Tivoli, you say, we are each the love of someone's life. And then as Max gets into his reverse life, his mother says, be what you think that you are, what they think you are. And in The Story of a Marriage, she starts out by saying, we think we know the ones we love, but I think they spend most of their time trying to be what people think they are, but knowing very seriously that they're not. And both novels have to do with people re-meeting their loves again and again. Is this an obsession?
Well, it sounds like it is when you say it that way. I always think that when people ask me about the themes of my book, I would say I would never have written down for you what I thought troubled my mind all the time, and that I'm fairly surprised when there turn out to be patterns, because I don't mean it to be that way, but then the book, I think, always starts turning back to that. But I think I like the idea of the at least second chances, or which is also takes the form of doubt in The Story of a Marriage.
Yeah, and in the case of Max Tivoli, which is sort of an escapade, we're not going to talk about it much today, but there's not too much in the plot that we wouldn't want to reveal. In The Story of a Marriage, though, so much changes so often in the book. You think you know what's going on, and all of a sudden you don't, and there's a major change at, I think, page 48. Mm-hmm. And after that, the ground is always shifting under our feet.
Well, it makes your job very hard to talk about.
Exactly.
You have 48 pages to work with, and the rest is difficult. They're a different kind of books that way. Well, because I think Max Tivoli also had a sort of large conceit to it of someone aging backwards, and then Story of a Marriage doesn't have that. And yet I wanted it to be intriguing and a page-turner in some way, and I found myself, or at least I was discovering ways of telling the story that would withhold information and slowly give it out.
It's also, though, much, it seems to me, much more subdued book. I wouldn't want to say quite somber, but Max Tivoli, I said a couple minutes ago, was almost like an escapade. And it goes all over the country. It plays with history. You delight in describing 70 years of events. The story of a marriage pretty much takes place in 6 months in 1953, but there are some flashbacks and some important flashbacks, but it's very concentrated and doesn't have the same looseness or vivacity.
I know, it's true. I think one critic said it was humorless, which is, I guess Max Tivoli is a little, it's somewhat lighthearted in ways, but this book somehow the tone started to take over, and once I started reading about the 50s, I was really became obsessed with the anxiety and fear of at least the early 50s, and it bleeds into the book itself, which is really a book of anxiety. I think also my own mood and the mood of the country the last 4 years made me introspective.
There are some wonderful images and some two or three page almost set pieces that are delightful to read. But one that comes to mind, I think it's Holland, the husband. He's leaning back against the wall, looking out to sea, and his body has sort of the shape of California looking at Asia.
Yeah.
And there's lovely touches like that all through the book, but most of it is rather anxious. And of course, it's a person who Max Tivoli had more than his share of heartbreak, but in this case of Pearlie and Holland, you know that the major happiness of their life is riding on one or two decisions.
It's true. I think for me, Max Tivoli was a sort of extroverted novel, and this was an introverted novel. I really, after that 70 years and crossing America, I really wanted to see if I could do something private, quiet, although I'm not sure it's that quiet a novel in a way. I think it sort of has a series of bombs that go off in it. Limited characters, limited amount of time, and really focus on their psychology. And somewhat about the era, although I think Max was a lot more about sort of like playing with history in that way. This was concentrating on a particular moment.
Although both of them have a love of the city of San Francisco in them, and in this case you go from the fashionable parts of Max Tivoli to what we now call the Sunset, which was once called the Outside Lands, and how it developed and how the different racial and sexual communities sort of coexisted, not very well, in that time and place.
Well, it interested me. It was once I picked 53, it was a little difficult because San Francisco is, parts of it are so well known. You know, North Beach in the mid 50s is beatnik, and you know, Chinatown or you imagine the men in gray fedoras downtown sitting drinking martinis, and I didn't want anything to do with that. So instead, I tried to pick a part of town that didn't typify that and was sort of quieter part of town. And then also, what came with it, the fog, things that a writer likes, is the imagery of a sun setting right behind the fog, right out by the ocean. There was so much to discover in that part of town.
And I have a feeling there might be just a change in your personal approaches, or did you just sit down and say, well, now I'll write a more serious novel? Or you say that the last 4 years have been a tenser time.
Yeah, I think so. I think I, Max Tivoli was a book that I took on as just an impossible challenge to myself, and I did it without thinking I'd ever publish it. And so I had a great time with it. And once that was done, it's true. I started in 2004. We had George Bush reelected, which put me in a pretty bad mood, and I was sort of cast my mind back to another period of time of the same kind of anxiety and fear of this time of terrorism, but back then of a variety of enemies, and repression. and try to think. And that was necessary for my story, because it's really the story of how a woman in a very repressed and constricted time period, how her choices would be limited, and she might be drawn into an unusual situation.
She's limited in that way, but she's also a reader and a thinker, and she's not... She knows what she has to do, given the constraints of her time, but she also knows there's a world outside what she has to do, and in some ways that makes it better, in some ways it makes it worse.
I think so. Well, that was the appeal of it for me. I struggled a long time to get the right narrator, and I knew she had to be a reader, not only because I wanted to use a certain kind of language. It's told from her point of view, so she has to be, a good storyteller. But also someone who has she's in a tiny little world, and then a man comes along to her door one day and sort of gives her the possibility of a different one that is, though a fantasy, appealing, and she's sort of taken up by the dream of it for a while because she's read about this kind of thing.
But she's also appalled by it.
Yeah, well, she has a very mixed reaction. Well, I don't know if mixed is even right. She's forced along a path in a lot of ways. But this man who offers her a bargain, in a way, she has an alliance with him, even though he's the enemy of her life.
But he's also a co-conspirator, and she says at one point, we don't really want to think of this, but we are friends.
Yeah. I think so. She denies it at one point and then later really realizes he's really the only friend she has. They're both in this situation of being not only marginal members of society, but knowing they're marginal members of society.
And with her husband, she has known and loved him for years, but he never completely opens up to her. And in the novel, there are two occasions when he almost does, and well, toward the end he does more, but never as completely as you would expect from somebody who's been married that long.
I know they're completely silent with each other. I can't tell you how difficult that was to write. I wrote whole scenes of them having much longer, more open conversations, and I finally had to submit to the realization that was not in him to do. And that the heart of the novel was, and this is where the first line finally came from, was about his ambiguity as a person and their marriage. I think I thought a lot about my grandparents, who never talked about a thing with each other.
And were they in any way members of sort of sub-societies?
Well, the story is very loosely based on a recollection of my grandmother's, where one day a man came to her door in Kentucky, or they were driving in a car, she said, and he stopped the car and he turned to her and he told her something very shocking about my grandfather, similar to what happens in the book.
Uh-huh.
And she told him just to get out of there, and she always regretted it, because in a way he was offering her a way out of her marriage. And she could not imagine a woman like her, who had never had a job, who was poor in rural Kentucky, raising two boys, what it would be like to be on her own was unimaginable. And at the end of her life, this story no one believes in my family, it could be completely fictitious, but it interested me, the idea that she always kept with her the sense that she'd been born at the wrong time.
So if nobody in your family believed this, how did you hear about it?
Well, she told everyone.
Oh, okay.
But it was always, oh, that story Grandma tells.
But did she tell them while your grandfather was still alive?
No. And they never talked about it, she or my grandfather. It's incredible what
yes.
you can live through.
Now, Max Tivoli, when we talked about it, it was obvious that there's some sort of homages to Vladimir Nabokov, and in the story of a marriage, it on the jacket blurb, they even refer to Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, and
yeah.
I thought when Pearlie describes the books she's read that enlivened her imagination, she mentions Flaubert, Ford, and Ferber, which is a pretty strange combination.
It is.
But The Good Soldier is sort of the the classic example of a novel with a totally unreliable narrator, unreliable to the point where you don't even know in the end what he knows and doesn't know. I didn't quite get that feeling with Pearlie. I thought in the end she was pretty clear about what she knew and didn't know, but I was always wondering if in your mind, if you were thinking of that, if the good soldier was somewhere in your mind, since it pops up in those two places, and what you know about what she knows.
Well, the good soldier is definitely where I started in writing this book when I was searching for a way into telling the story. I mean, I tried all kinds of ways, the way you do when you start a novel. I told it from all kinds of points of view. The characters were utterly different. And I remember the good soldier, and I thought, well, this is the way. And in the beginning, Pearlie was a lot like that narrator, sort of angry, embittered, and deceptive. That ended up not working, and I changed her utterly. But I still kept and was inspired by the idea of the withheld story and the retelling of the same scene over and over again, and kept some little references to the good soldier in there just to tip my hand to you that I knew what I was doing.
I sort of thought that the dance in Marin County, was that one of those?
Yeah, that was one. There's twin aunts that tell her not to marry him, and it's something similar happens in The Good Soldier.
I'd forgotten that part.
The good news was that it was a great way for me to enter the book, and then it was a great way to put The Good Soldier down, and it became its own book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think she knows what she's doing. She's looking back with retrospect, and with, I think the big breakthrough was for me, 40 years have passed or something for her telling this story. If she's still angry about it, it would be a very unattractive feature in a person. And I liked the idea that she had empathy and understanding for the other characters. Now that time had passed, I really enjoyed writing that story more.
And I would say in the end, both Pearlie and Colin, for all their shortcomings, come across as basically very admirable people.
That's good to hear. Yeah. It's not how it seems like it's going to start at the beginning, but I'm glad to hear that.
So this story came out of your life. As I said, I have only known two of your books, and they are, in some ways, have such similar themes, and in other ways are so completely different in tone. And you talk about writing the way a novelist does. You start a story, you start with an idea, and you try another and another and another. Do you think, in the end, more of it comes out of your models, like Nabokov or Ford, or out of your own life, or just out of the writing process?
Well, it comes out, it comes out of just tempering it, beating it over and over with a hammer, that it's every part. I would say it's much more the books I read that influence me than my autobiography. I have very little temptation to put myself in the books, although I always identify with one character. I always think they look like me and act like I would in my maybe worst moods. But otherwise, the great struggle is to let the story sort of go out of my control and to depart from its model and hopefully be something new in that way. That's the real hard part, and the part that's full of doubt, and, the fun part, the reason you do it.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, I think one of the things that comes through is your love for San Francisco and its different aspects. And I imagine that the getting away from there is also fascinating. One of the characters, the precipitating, catalytic character, turns out to have been part of the great hunger experiment in Minneapolis during World War II.
Yeah.
And I know somebody who was in that experiment.
Do you
as
really?
Well. Yeah. And it was horrendous, but they have totally, they responded totally differently. The person I know cannot imagine wasting anything after this, and the thought of food going uneaten is a horror to him. Whereas the character, your character, comes to attain a great deal of power and to really enjoy exercising this power over other people.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although in my better judgment, some of it, I think of him as someone also who had just sort of reached the end of a tether and broke and felt like, in a way, not wasting a moment of his life on anything except figuring out what he desired from it. I think he thinks he's a good guy and has figured out a great solution for everyone to have what they want and to just stop messing around.
It's so strange talking with you because there are books I've discussed in the past that have surprise endings or things that happen halfway through, but we're skirting around all these facts, all these analyzing the character's emotions without saying what really happens.
I know, we are. Well, we can talk about some of it if you want. We can just warn people, slight spoilers are ahead.
Well,
I've had every kind of interview about it.
We only have a few more minutes, so is there anything that you'd like to say to, you know, because we do want people to read this book. It is a fascinating, wonderful book, and maybe they'd be more interested if they knew a little bit more about it.
I know.
Or maybe we should keep it the way it is.
Sounds a bit too vague. Well, the one thing I usually tell people is that I say, you know, it's about a woman in the sunset, and then a man, Buzz is his name, this man who was part of the hunger experiment, comes to her door one day, an old war friend of her husband's. And this part I often tell people of the book is that, like my grandmother's story, he comes and says, I was your husband's lover in the war, and I want to leave with him, and I want to make you a bargain. And he offers her money, but more than that, he offers her a kind of sense of freedom. It's really, for me, not the main surprise of the book. The main surprise we won't talk about.
No.
But there's a pleasure, I hope, built into the book of the reader being surprised at how the assumptions they come to when reading or in creating characters in their heads, much like the way that Pearlie, her experience in sort of creating her husband in her head, she sort of invented huge parts of him and has to confront the fact that she did it, not him. It's her, the way you imagine sort of parts of the people you know.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Andrew Sean Greer about his latest novel, The Story of a Marriage. He's going to be at the Sac State, the University Union Ballroom, next Monday at 1 p.m. as part of the California Lecture Series, but this is different. Most of those are in the evening, and most of them you have to pay for. This one's in the afternoon, and it's free. What are you going to offer to...
Well, I think I'm going to talk a lot about... I'll talk about California history, but what I love to talk about is this started out not just as my grandmother's story, but a short story I wrote and grew into a novel. And I think it's interesting to look at actually similar passages and see how something goes from an idea into a novel. That's always what people ask, where do your ideas come from? And this is one of the few cases where I can point exactly where a paragraph, how it grew.
And has the story been published?
No, I could never publish it because it was a failed story, which is a sign that it's either a bad story or that it's a novel.
Uh-huh.
It was packed with too much. I wanted to say more than a story could hold.
And how long did that take? When did you write the story?
Oh, I wrote the story before Max Tivoli. It was my favorite thing I ever wrote, and I could not publish it. And it was only after Max Tivoli that I turned back to it and saw that it was richer than at least the story format I was willing to write in. Something under 25 pages could hold.
So
it became a novel.
It became a novel, and my listeners are forewarned that... And on next Monday, you'll just read a section from the story and then a section from the novel?
Well, I have little bits, but I have... I think what's interesting is to sort of talk about how a change comes about and then what it reveals about the book itself and how it sort of grows in your mind into a novel. Gets, I would think, what Nabokov called claws and wings.
Okay, so that'll be next Monday, April 20th at 1 p.m. at the University Union Ballroom at Sac State University. Andrew Sean Greer talking about The Story of a Marriage and, I'm sure, quite a lot more. So thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks a lot.
If you have another, I'm actually only going to do this program for another 15 months, and you probably won't have a novel out in that time.
Oh, alas, no. Oh, well, then, congratulations
on
your tenure.
Okay. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
The second half of Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. In this half of the program, I want to talk with another person I consider an old friend, although I've never met him before, and that's David Carl, whose latest entry in the California Natural History Guide series is Introduction to Water in California. Actually, he published this a number of years ago. This is a revised edition, but it's the first time I've had a chance to talk to him about it. Welcome back to Booktown, Dave.
Here.
Oops, there. I didn't have you on for a second.
Oh, but are we on now?
Now you're on now.
I just said I'm really glad to be back with you. It's good to be on with you again, Eric.
Well, thank you. This book, in some ways, is the scariest of all of your books. You deal with pretty dire subjects, fire and air, including air pollution. But water, well, we're more dependent on air than anything, but water comes next, and the California water situation is not very pretty right now.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's not meant to be a scary book. In fact, it's meant to help people understand something that's very much a part of the world and life on this earth, and I don't consider that scary. But where we've come and what we've done in terms of water and how we've transformed the state of California, yeah, there's aspects of that are certainly disturbing, and we are, many people are talking about a water crisis right now, in the last year especially in California. So it's a big issue.
One of the best things about this book is, in a way, it's a poor person's water atlas of California. I always envied the people who wanted to put out the money to buy that when it came out in the late 70s. I think even then it cost $50 or $75.
Yeah, and it's the one you're talking about, a very big tome.
Yeah, and this is small, but it has some maps that are just as beautiful in their way and just as informative and right up to date. When I first started looking through them, there was a couple that really scared me. One was the Bay Area, and it was showing the urban extent and the tidal wetlands around the Bay Area, and the wetlands extended way up, but all the way down to San Jose, but then way up to Sacramento River in San Joaquin. But today they are almost gone. There's almost tiny green spots, and the red of urban is huge, and that means essentially, in some ways, we've destroyed one of our greatest natural resources.
Yeah, and you know, that there's bad news there. There's challenges there. There's also some good news. Some of those wetland areas that had been filled in or turned into other things like salt ponds, salt production ponds, and all. There's efforts underway all the time in recent years to try to restore some of that tidal wetland. And I got to visit some of those areas just this last fall, actually, where they're doing a lot of work in the northern San Pablo Bay. And so there's good things there, too. But we have, I think one of the things that Californians have trouble with envisioning is just how much change has occurred. It's really fascinating to me to go back and look at the old records of California and what the environment was, and and realize how much transformation has gone on. So when you hear figures like, well, we've lost 90% of our wetlands, well, that translates into something very, very large on the ground.
Another map that I'll just mention as we get going was on page 89, and it shows the regional water distribution, and it shows particular areas like the North Coast, Sacramento, San Joaquin, Central Coast, how much water comes from these areas and how much goes into them. And right in the middle is an area called Tulare Lake. And I said, no, Tulare Lake hasn't been there for, I don't know, 100 years? And then I went to one of your other maps, which shows it being bigger than Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, we're talking about a body of water that was in the southern San Joaquin Valley. And a couple of the rivers down in coming out of the Sierra Nevada at the south end actually never turned and ran out through the delta to San Francisco Bay, but except in the wettest years when they would be able to. But normally they would just terminate there at this lake called Tulare Lake, where if you look at the maps today, or if you drive Interstate 5 or Highway 99 down through that part of the world, you just have no awareness that it used to be this big body of water, because it's been drained and turned into farmland. And what water was running in that direction is still a lot of it being applied to the land, but to grow crops. There are the wet years when the lake insists on coming back, when there's so much flood water that there's no way to divert it anymore away from that low point. And so there always are those, every 15, 20 years, there'll be a year where all of a sudden, if you drive that stretch of California, you might get a feel for that there used to be a very large body of water there. It was shallow, it fluctuated enormously, and it was a big draw. Like anywhere with water is a big draw for life, and there was lots of wildlife around there. A lot of the tule elk that used to be, thousands and thousands and thousands of elk that occupied the Central Valley, the southern San Joaquin Valley, that was their turf, that was their territory. They liked those wetlands. And so it was a very rich place for birds and just completely transformed. Yeah, that's a gigantic change. That graphic that you started by talking about, I think is one of my favorite in the book, because it's a way to visualize with big blue arrows the movements, the way we've replumbed California water by moving it from the north primarily to the south, or from the Colorado River area westward towards the coast. And a way to just look at that very quickly and see these big blue movements of arrows on that graphic showing how we've redesigned the water system of the state.
And now those arrows show water going into the Tulare Lake area from the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers.
And that's to serve farming. Basically, that's the Central Valley Project, especially. That's a federal project that begins with the up north in the Sacramento River, where Shasta Dam is, and then a whole series of other dams that are involved. And then an aqueduct that comes out of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and sends water southward through the valley and ends up there to serve primarily agriculture. There's also some of the State Water Project, the separate facility that's the California Aqueduct. And again, it's originating up out of the Sacramento Valley, and there we're talking about up in the Feather River area through Oroville. But again, at the south end of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, we get a canal started, the California Aqueduct, and it's primarily sending water all the way down to urban users in Southern California, but some of that water does make its way down into the valley also.
So most of this replumbing you talk about has been to give water to the San Francisco Bay Area, to Southern California, and to agriculture.
Exactly, yeah. Many people talking about California and water make the point that the way our development and our demand historically developed in the state, we have an imbalance where people ended up concentrating and growing, and populations and cities grew in areas where there was not so much water. And the only way they were able to do that was to bring water to do this transformation. They really astonishingly gigantic Herculean efforts that were involved, when you step back and look at it, to to take water from hundreds of miles away and bring it to another place that doesn't have very much water, so that you can change what can happen there. So you can make real estate, become more valuable, essentially.
And at one point, we were incredibly proud of all of this plumbing, and now we're kind of queasy.
I think many people probably still are proud of it, although to me, the issue is how far? When is too much enough? Or we've always seemed to have had a philosophy in this state that's driven this kind of incredible energy that too much is never enough, that we've got to, essentially, we about 100 years ago, with the beginning of the Los Angeles aqueduct system, our engineers, our planners decided to try to create a system for the California cities where water would no longer be a limit. It just wouldn't be a limiting factor. Now, that worked that way for a while because we moved so much water. We set the system up, but we are back. We're at a point now where we've run up against the limits again at things, and so we're back where we've got a lot of tension in the water world right now.
And a huge amount of that water is wasted.
Well, that's certainly a big factor. And in fact, there's a graphic in the new book, in the new edition, that comes out of the latest state water plan effort, and it's a bar graph that shows where are the greatest opportunities for increasing water supply possibilities. And the bars are pretty small these days for things like dams and the old aqueducts, the old concrete path that got us to where we are now. And with the large bars, where there's real opportunities to do a lot, are with water conservation, doing better with what we have, and things like water recycling, reusing water that we've used once and not just sending it out to sea through our sewers, but finding ways to reclaim it and make more use of it. There's tremendous amounts of opportunity there, and there's been a lot of some very good examples, actually, in Southern California. The city of Los Angeles, the city of Long Beach are doing some really impressive things with water conservation and stretching their supplies so that, for example, the city of Los Angeles, for the last 30 years, with all the growth they've had over those 30 years in population, they have not increased their total use of water in the city. They've been able to decrease the net use per person, and they've held steady at the total amount of water that they're using. And that's just because of things like low flush toilets, not just making that a voluntary thing, but actually replacing all of their customers, as many as they can, their old wasteful toilets with these low flush toilets, and doing it free. That's part of the city water department does that as a part of their program, and that alone, there's many other things. We can talk about landscaping and all kinds of things, but that one toilet replacement program has just been a tremendous savings of water every time people flush.
And they've even been able to take less water from the Owens Valley.
They've been able to, and of course they've had to, and too, also because of court decisions. And in part that goes all the way back to now to 1994. It's getting to be a while since the Mono Lake decision was finalized, where we are now protecting Mono Lake. This is where I live, and I worked here for a long time. And the lake is recovering. The city's only able to take about a third of the water that it had been from the streams around Mono Lake, and that's could have been the city turn around and grab some water somewhere else to replace it. But instead, part of the whole Mono Lake protection decision was to reach out and develop these water conservation programs with the toilets and with water reclamation. The city's also taking less water now out of the Owens River farther south, and some of that is a requirement to put a little of the water back into the dry Owens lake bed, not to recreate a lake, but to control the dust storms that come off of that lake bed because of the air quality, the air pollution issue there.
So now that problem has to some degree been solved, and I guess the biggest single problem facing us right now is the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta.
Yeah, that's a gigantic problem for sure. There are some other big ones, too. The Colorado River situation
is
also very big because there's so much water that the southern state was taking from the Colorado River. And the issue there, just before we get to the Delta, which is enormous, but the Colorado issue really goes back to the fact that the state was after many years of using more water than the state actually had rights to, because other states were not prepared. Arizona and Nevada, for decades, had not been able to take all the water they had their rights to. Well, that caught up with us, and so we had to cut back by hundreds of thousands of acre feet and start living within our actual entitlement on the Colorado River. So that tightens things up in one place. What's going on in the Delta, of course, is an example of asking too much of what a water system can actually do. You know, we basically have tried to use the Delta as a place to send water southward, to do farming with it, to grow cities with it and urban populations. And at the same time, the Delta system supports this incredible coastal estuary with enormous amount of life, including everything from the real obvious big stars of the show, the salmon, that the salmon runs that used to be enormous coming up through the Delta and into the rivers of the Sierra Nevada, but all the way down to some much smaller, seemingly less significant, at least to people, fish like the Delta smelt. And these fish species, the whole length of the food chain now is really in trouble, and there's been this gigantic collapse, particularly in the last 6 or 8 years. It happens to coincide with a period of time around the year 2000 when they started increasing the amount of water being pumped out of the Delta into the aqueducts, and then this big collapse came, and species like the Delta smelt and are listed as endangered, and there's efforts underway to try to, you know, help that, and that has made it the ability to pump water into the aqueducts less of a reliable thing in order to meet all of these various requirements that are now there. And so all of these things together, if you put the whole package of less water out of the Eastern Sierra to Los Angeles, to the Colorado River cutbacks, the situation in the Delta, throw in a few years of drier than average winters, and that's why people are talking about a water crisis at this point. Things have come to a head.
There was a large piece in the Chronicle yesterday in their insights section about how they say replumb the state to save the fish and us, and the authors say that the most promising long-term strategy for native fishes alone is to end water exports entirely. But then they say, at a still greater water supply and economic cost. So they then suggest that the peripheral canal that was defeated 25 years ago by the voters might be they want it to come back.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in the environmental community in what could be done with a different way of plumbing the Delta, and that's this. You know, right now water comes down the river systems into the Delta, and then at the southward end of that estuary, that's where the pumps take the water out and into the aqueducts. By taking the water out farther north and sending it around the periphery, around the edge of the Delta, and keeping it separate, a number of things can happen. Those things are good for the urban users and what they're trying to accomplish in terms of their clean water. The big question, though, is, you know, to help the Delta's ecosystem, now this all this collapse of the fisheries and biology there, it more water needs to move through the Delta. And what the reason why some environmentalists are interested in the canal option now is that it offers some ways to move the water in different directions across the Delta, back westward towards its old place of going, out to the bay. And not just, one of the things that happens with these powerful pumps that feed the aqueducts is that they actually reverse tidal flows. And instead of water moving from, you know, out towards the ocean, water can reverse its flow and actually flow southward just towards those pumps. All of these things cause problems for the biological system. It's not quite working the way it should. And then, of course, the pumps actually kill the small fish. So if there's a commitment there, if we decide to go that direction with the facility, and then if it is managed in order to accomplish these dual goals of more reliability for the urban users and the farm users, but also at the same time try to restore and improve the ecosystem of the Delta, if all that can be done using a peripheral canal, there's a lot of interest there. There are many of us who are skeptical that if you put that facility in place, that the powerful interests that have driven the water story for California for all these decades that are focused on economic growth, that they will override these concerns about the ecosystem, and that they'll just have the ability to separate the water out of the delta and not keep enough in it. And that's a big question. And it, you know, there are many, many people who are at work in these various negotiations and various studies, and they have all that in mind. They see all of that, but they're trying their best to see if there's a way to work out a system that will assure people that all these good ends perhaps can be achieved. I'll tell you, unless we ever can resolve the thirst end on the human side, this growth, this thing about our numbers and how much thirst we apply to the system, everything is going to continue to be stressed. That's the bottom line. We've got to find some way towards a sustainable relationship with water in California.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and we've gone through all the problems up to now, and there's two we haven't addressed, and those are drought and climate change.
Sure. Well, drought is an interesting thing in terms of calling it a problem, because it's normal weather for California. It's not average. We can do a graph what is average ups and downs each year of how much water falls in the state. But wet cycles and dry cycles and a great tremendous amount of fluctuation is normal weather for California. And one of my pet peeves is that in planning in regards to water and growth decisions is that we don't basically start with that realization that droughts will come. And if we plan to be able to live well during droughts, then we will live well the rest of the time. But typically we don't do it that way. And so here we are. We're in a mild drought right now, actually, but we're in another kind of drought that's more to do with all this situation about problems that we face. And in that sense, drought can be something that has very little to do with climate, in a sense. It's more a matter of the difference between supply and demand, and our demand just keeps growing. Now, the other thing is climate change. And climate change has got water planners quite concerned, because the forecast, the models, the expectations of what it'll do for California is that we will end up with a harder water supply to manage. We've always been able to rely on the snowpack as our greatest, largest reservoir, where snow falls in the mountains and it slowly melts, and we are able to use that water as it melts, and we've had a system that works with that. And it looks like we're going to get smaller snowpacks, more precipitation arriving as rain, and actually now the latest models are more and more convinced we're going to actually have less precipitation too overall, less water falling on the state. And all of that is yet another concern when you throw in with the problems we had without climate change in the picture, 10 years ago when people weren't thinking as much about that. And now it's definitely a whole nother ball game, and it's getting very interesting.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with David Carl about his new edition of Introduction to Water in California. We're out of time now. We've only really touched on maybe a quarter of the topics addressed in this book. It's really packed with information, and I recommend it very highly. And the one question I always ask, are you ever going to do an introduction to Earth?
You know what? Yesterday I finished writing the first draft of that book, which will be out sometime next year. It takes quite a while after I finish writing before books actually reach print. But by sometime early next year, I hope you folks will be able to see the complete series. By then we'll have Earth, Air, Water, and Fire in California as the four books that I set out about a decade ago to start writing, and I'm just about to wrap that up, and I'm real pleased with that.
Okay, thanks so much, David Carl.
Thank you, Art.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And this has been Booktown. Before ending, a couple of things coming up. This is National Poetry Month, and there's a couple of events going along with that. The Nevada County Poetry Series celebrates National Poetry Month with B.L. Kennedy and Mario Ellis Hill this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, and you can get information at 432-8196. And another one is Poems for the Night Shift on Saturday, an evening of poetry, mumblings, dreams, and drink. featuring the fine purveyors of aforementioned items, Matt Amott, Judy Valen, Todd Cirillo, and Will Staple. It wasn't five, it was the fine purveyors. And that's going to be at the North Columbia Schoolhouse Cultural Center on Saturday at 7:30 p.m. And another thing happening Saturday is Books Across the Water, a benefit concert to raise awareness and bring books to an impoverished South African township school. The event takes place Saturday beginning at 5:30 p.m. at St. Joseph's Cultural Center in Grass Valley. It features music by the Moore Brothers, Luke Janella, Casual Fog, and author Kim Culbertson. So I am running out of time. Stay tuned for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.